Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Millions of people across the country are voting as the government shutdown continues. This morning, Donald Trump threatened to deny food stamp payments to 42 million people until the shutdown ends, even though a federal court ordered the administration to continue funding the program. Over the weekend, just hours before food aid expired, Trump threw a Great Gatsby-themed Halloween party at Mar-a-Lago. Later in the show, we'll check in with a few food banks to find out how people are faring. But first, we'll talk about the election. If Prop 50 passes in California, Democrats would have an advantage in five districts currently held by Republicans. Prop 50 is Governor Gavin Newsom's response to racial gerrymandering in Texas, which was ordered by Donald Trump. There are also governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey and the widely watched mayor's race in New York. Which races are you watching? What are your thoughts about Election Day today and Prop 50? Also, if you have any comments or questions about the continued shutdown, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by two guests. Irene Gao is Executive Director of Courage California, a nonprofit fighting for a more progressive California. Irene has worked for community-based nonprofits in the state for over 20 years, including in public housing and early childhood education. Hi, Irene. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. John Nichols is executive editor of The Nation. He previously served as the magazine's national affairs correspondent and Washington correspondent. John Nichols has written, co-written, or edited over a dozen books. His latest, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is the New York Times bestseller, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Hi, John. Thanks so much for joining us again.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Rose, and with my fellow guest.
Great to have both of you. I want to start off by asking you both to comment on the news that we're just hearing from Trump. So 42 million people receive food stamps, now called SNAP, and a federal court ordered the administration to continue funding the program. But this morning, Trump is threatening to deny food stamp payments to people who really need them. Irene, what are your thoughts on this? We did a show about this last week. I mean, people are really struggling to make ends meet, pay their bills, and put food on the table. And now they're getting this news.
Yeah, it's really devastating. And I think it's also really timely that this is happening around this election period. I think, as you mentioned, a lot of people are struggling. So 5.5 million of those people who are facing or are dealing with these cuts to SNAP are here in California. And a lot of those folks are concentrated in rural and agricultural regions of the state. These are the folks who are on the front lines of dealing with the devastation from this administration. And so today, what's really so important and what's important about this Prop 50 election is that this is a way for California voters and the people of California to really fight back against the administration and against these sort of harmful cuts that really, really harm a lot of our communities across the board.
To your point, the San Francisco Chronicle has a piece out yesterday by Danielle Echeverria, and Danielle reports that this is hitting Tulare and Imperial counties very hard. 27% of residents in those counties receive benefits through CalFresh. That's California's SNAP program. And then the other highest areas are parts of Lake County and then Fresno and Kern counties in the Central Valley. And so people are really struggling to figure out how they're going to feed their families. We should also say that in California, children make up more than 40% of CalFresh recipients. John, I have to ask you, as a longtime journalist, 42 million people receiving SNAP, journalists should really be writing articles and talking about the high poverty rate in this country. I mean, to think that 42 million people are on SNAP, that is a lot of people in a country of, what is it, 320 or so million people?
It's absolutely a lot of people. And it is only one measure of poverty and economic disorder in this country. There are many folks who don't access SNAP for a variety of reasons, but access all sorts of other programs, including, I would note, healthcare programs that are also currently under tremendous threat and in some cases being pulled back. When you look around the United States of America, the one thing that is universal in every state, in every region, urban, rural, suburban, is poverty. This is the wealthiest country in the world, and yet it has an immense level of poverty. And as you note, very much among children, but also among all sorts of other folks, including, and I think this is one of the most important things to note, people who get up before dawn, take a bus, sometimes many miles, go to work, work all day, come back, you know, at this time of year when it's already getting dark, to take care of their kids and do all the other responsibilities of life, and they don't make enough money to get above the poverty line.
Right.
Because in many states in this country, we still are at the federal minimum wage, which is an obscenity. It is incomprehensible. So bottom line is, we're going to talk about politics a little on this show. This should be central to our politics. And it is for some political figures. It is important to note, Senator Bernie Sanders never gives a speech where he doesn't talk about this. He's made it central to his politics. Same is true of some other folks like Ro Khanna and Barbara Lee. But they are not even the Democratic Party. They are the left of the Democratic Party. And tragically, in our politics, poverty is not a central issue, not the central issue that it should be.
Why do you think that is the case, John? According to the Poor People's Campaign, there are more than 140 million poor and low-wealth people in this country. A lot of these people do not vote because they feel like politicians do not care about them, do not put any policy prescriptions in place that would improve their lives. And it's, again, I always repeat this on the show, that 90 million people did not vote in this last election. So why is it that so few Democrats really talk about these issues?
You know, look, Democrats respond to money. And this is like our whole society. By and large, in our society, both political parties have decided that the easiest way to do politics is to collect money from very wealthy people and to put ads on television, or maybe even do some door-to-door work, to mobilize the people who regularly vote. It is much more demanding, not more expensive, but more demanding to go out and actually organize the people who don't vote. And remember, people who don't vote are a substantial portion of our population, and many of them don't vote because of poverty. They're not making a political statement. Now, I fully accept there are some people who don't vote because they see no point to it, or they're frustrated by both parties, et cetera. But I will tell you, somebody who's interviewed a lot of folks who are living below the poverty line and do not regularly vote, who will say, you know, look, I care. I want to be involved. But it's just very hard when you get up in the morning to take, you know, make sure your kids can get off to school. And then sometimes you walk to work at a McDonald's or a Wendy's or something like that, put in your shift, walk home, maybe you can catch a bus, just in time to take care of your kids. And I've met folks who then, after they've gotten their kids settled in at home, go out and do more work, right? And as a result, in this country where we make voting very, very, very hard, in not California does better than many places, there's a lot of places where it's hard to vote. You have to travel to do it. You have to jump through all sorts of hoops. And so the bottom line is, we live in a country where, on top of all the other abuses, we make it easy for wealthy and connected people to vote, for upper middle class people to vote. We make it hard for an awful lot of working class people to vote. And it's getting harder because the Trump administration is literally attacking all sorts of vehicles that might ease the burden to some extent. To give you an example, in Maine today, they are voting on whether to get rid of absentee voting, right? Well, absentee voting is pretty important to all kinds of people, because, you know, certainly to folks who are, in, you know, who are ailing and at home, but also to people who, you know, on Tuesday, I got to vote. Or, I mean, I'm sorry, I apologize. On Tuesday, I have to work. And if you've got a demanding job, you got to work all day, absentee voting might be an avenue by which you could do it. If you eliminate that, well, then who does the advantage go to? It goes to the people who can take an hour off or 2 hours off to go vote.
Right. Well, and to your point, and we'll talk about this later in the show and again on Thursday, what's been incredible about Zoran Mamdani, regardless of what you think of his politics, he is bringing out so many new voters to the polls, young people, people of color, people who feel like, why should I get involved in politics? Because politicians don't care about me, don't talk about me. Well, he's bringing them out to vote. So we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But before we do that, I also wanted to get your thoughts, Irene, on the poverty rate and whether or not California Democrats really talk about this. California's poverty rate is almost 18%. It's among the highest in the nation, with kids, people of color, and renters most affected. According to the California Budget and Policy Center, about 7 million state residents lack the resources to meet their basic needs. What does it look like in Sacramento in terms of Democrats at the state level? Are they talking about, are many of state politicians talking about poverty?
I would say a lot of politicians in Sacramento are talking about affordability. And I see that as being connected to, but not directly about poverty. I do think that the most progressive state legislators are pushing a lot more bolder policies to address poverty itself. So a lot of it has to do with raising wages, protecting worker rights, making childcare more affordable and more accessible, providing guaranteed basic income. There's a lot of really good ideas that are being pushed in Sacramento by progressive legislators, but a lot of times those aren't making it all the way through. I mean, similar to what John mentioned, partly because a lot of Democrats are also beholden to some industries. But I think also part of it is there is a reluctance to really tackle wealth and income inequality. So, you know, here in California, there have been conversations about what does it look like to have a billionaire's tax? So what does that mean if that can help us fund more of these social safety net programs that we know help to keep people out of poverty? But it's been a challenge every single year to actually get some of those policies passed or some of those budget policies incorporated. The other thing I want to mention too that I think is really important is I do feel like nowadays politicians are very beholden to polling and research. And so oftentimes they lead with what they see as being popular, but oftentimes it's not always the right policies or the morally right thing that we should be doing. And then on top of that, polling and research really, again, biases towards likely voters. And so we're missing the opinions and the voices a lot of people in poverty. Again, for the same reasons that John mentioned that people who are in poverty don't necessarily have the ability or time to vote. They also don't have the time or ability to participate in research and polls that really now drives a lot of politicians. But when I do see the politicians who are really driven a lot more by what they know are the policies we need to address poverty, those are the people who understand polling and research is part of it, but really just understand that addressing poverty and alleviating poverty is just a high priority no matter what.
Well, we just wanted to give you an update on the government shutdown and how this is affecting people who are struggling to make ends meet. And a little later in the show, we will check in with people who work at food banks to find out what they are hearing and how they're dealing with this, because so many people working at food banks say there's no way they can keep up with this. We're joined today by Irene Gao, Executive Director of Courage California, and John Nichols, Executive Editor of The Nation. So all eyes are on Prop 50 in California, and if it passes, Democrats would have an advantage in five districts currently represented by Republicans. And some of the information around Prop 50 is not getting as much attention as I think it deserves. So the League of Women Voters has a really good overview of Prop 50. They have not taken a position on this, but they want people to know about what it would actually do. So it would authorize temporary changes to congressional district maps. So this is all temporary. If Prop 50 passes, the maps would then have to be drawn again by the independent commission following the 2030 U.S. Census. So that's a really important point. And most people know that this is Governor Gavin Newsom's response to racial gerrymandering in Texas. And Donald Trump demanded that Texas redraw their maps. So, Irene, what else do you think people need to know about Prop 50?
Yeah, a couple of things. I think one thing that is really important to note is, as you mentioned, in Texas and in other Republican-led states, the only way that they can draw stronger lines for their Republican incumbents is to racially gerrymander. But here in California, what is really exceptional and important was that when these maps were drawn, so the maps that people are voting on today and have voted on for the last few weeks, really respect the Voting Rights Act. So it is really about actually protecting the voter power of voters of color. And in fact, it was recently found that the new maps actually could strengthen Latino voter power. Again, so a really clear contrast from the other states. The other really critical thing is, of course, today and what today and the past few weeks has been about is that ultimately, it's the voters who get to decide on whether these maps go into effect. And that's a difference that is really critical because in Texas and other states, voters and the public are just not invited into the process. So they don't have a say in the maps and they don't get to vote on the maps. But here in California, the state legislature made the maps available to the public, accepted public comment into them, and also the people who drew the maps also looked at public comment that was submitted in the 2020 cycle. So there are multiple points at which the public and voters have been brought into this process. And so that makes California really special and really unique. And I also think that's why a lot of groups here in California have been able to support this kind of proposition in a way that you don't see that kind of community or group support in the other states.
And John, it's so important to note that the NAACP has filed a lawsuit in Texas saying their new electoral map strips Black voters of their political power. So many of these gerrymandered districts are racial and they cut out people of color. And we mm-hmm. need to spend more time talking about that, John.
Of course we do. And we have a Supreme Court case right now that could blow up the Voting Rights Act, at least as we know it. So this is an incredibly tenuous point for voting rights with a capital VNR and also with a small VNR. And what I mean is a very tenuous moment for the Voting Rights Act itself. It is under threat. It is under attack. It is not being respected. It is being undermined in places like Texas, but also in other states. At the same time, in the broader sense of voting rights, what we have right now is a circumstance where there's a clear signal from the White House and from Republicans aligned with the White House that they're going to do everything they can to upend the ease, to the extent that it is easy, the ease with which we vote, the patterns by which we vote. They want to mess with things. And to give you another example, not one that hopefully doesn't take us too far off this core topic, is, you know, we have a situation where the president's talking about sending monitors into states, right, to observe voting, a traditional historic intimidation tactic. So when we look at it right now, we've got a real voting rights mess. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, who I've, you know, been lucky enough to know for a very long time, always argues, and I think this is important, that when they're coming at you on, you know, basic voting rights, on the maps, on things like this, and when they're doing it so aggressively, it is because they fear you. It is because they know that you're angry, that you're ready to turn out, that there is an energy here that has the power to displace Republican majorities in Washington and also in many states. That's a very significant thing because, of course, we've got to fight all these assaults, but we also have to recognize that there genuinely is power in the people. The higher the turnout, the more people are mobilized. What we're talking about in the first segment there, the more people are mobilized, the more you can push back on this. Even if the maps are bad, And you will see states like California that try to undo some of the damage. That's what Prop 50 is doing, and it's an important part of this. You're going to see lawsuits, petitions, initiatives in all sorts of other states around the country. 2026, which is coming, is going to be a battle for the right to vote. But the first stage in that comes today, because the results of elections around the country, even in this tenuous, very difficult time, are going to give us some very powerful signals as to whether people are ready to push back. And I can tell you this, that there's a lot of difference between Zohra Mamdani and, say, the gubernatorial candidates in Virginia and New Jersey. And yet, at the end of the night, if Zohra Mamdani wins by a comfortable margin in New York, if Democrats are elected as governors of New Jersey and Virginia, if California does Prop 50, if we see new mayors in places like Minneapolis and Seattle, and all sorts of other results in Pennsylvania, three Supreme Court justices that are up for renewal. If they are renewed, that keeps the court progressive. In Maine, if you beat back this assault on absentee voting, if that pattern comes together, by sometime tonight, we may have, or California, I know, counts a little more slowly, so it may be a few days, but in relatively short order, we may have a signal that the people are ready to mobilize, that they're ready to come out and do everything they can, with the recognition that this administration is going to be putting barriers in their way. It's going to be incredibly challenging. The lesson that Democrats, progressives should take away from those results is resources have to be poured into mobilization. Turnout has to be massively increased, because if you do that, you can overcome at least some and maybe many of the barriers that that this administration is trying to put in the way of democracy, and of a democracy that would hold them to account.
We're going to talk more about rigging elections, attempting to rig elections, on tomorrow's show. If you look at other gerrymandering news, and again, thanks to the League of Women Voters for this information, Missouri plans to help Republicans win one more seat. Indiana's governor says redistricting is probable. Kansas Republicans are working out details. Utah is taking public comment. Ohio has to redraw maps before the 2026 midterms. Louisiana Republicans are looking at times for a special session. I mean, John, the list is really long.
It's really long, but here's the counter on it. And look, I am not wearing rose-colored glasses here. I am not trying to tell you that, you know, we should not take this seriously. This is for real. They're doing this because they know they're in trouble. They know they have to flip seats, make it difficult, even impossible, for Democrats to win in certain areas, because they are expecting a surge of Democratic votes and Democratic wins in a lot of places. So here's the in a way, at least some element of good news. In Ohio, in Missouri, in several other states, if they do a redraw of this kind, there's good legal opinions that suggest it is possible to do an override referendum, i.e. to put a referendum on the ballot that stops the redraw for this year and that allows voters to reject it at the polls. So many of these things you're talking about may occur. Then there may be a next stage of pushback against them. The nightmare of it all is that we are very likely well into 2026 to be talking about maps and lines and and districts and stuff. The one key intervention I would say here is that in all of this uncertainty, you may get some of the lines back, you may lose some, it may be just a big mess. People in many places are going to be uncertain about where to vote. And so for media, for civic groups, for activists across this country, there is a baseline reality of making sure that people know where to vote and how to vote. And I know that sounds so basic that sometimes it doesn't sound as sexy, if you will, or whatever term we use, as some of the other things that we do in politics. But I'm going to tell you, one of the critical things to do is to make sure that when they're messing with the maps, whatever they draw, people know where and how to vote after or in the midst of that messing with the maps.
On the Democratic side, we should say that New York and Illinois and Maryland are looking at possibly redrawing their maps. And if you look at the states with all male voting, they're all Democratic states, including California, Hawaii, Vermont, and Washington. Oh, I got that wrong. It's also in Utah, all male voting. your final thoughts, Irene, about where we are right now and what you think today and the election results might tell us about where people, how people are feeling about the current state of affairs in this country.
Yeah, so a couple of things come to mind. So for me, today and the election results that we're hoping to see in the next couple of days, or maybe even as early as tonight, is both about the actual results of Prop 50 itself. So ideally, we want to see Prop 50 passed by a large enough margin where it's a really clear signal to this administration and to Republicans that Californians are rejecting their attempts to cut healthcare, to take away food assistance, all these important programs that really help our communities and our economy really thrive. The other important result that I'm really looking towards is what turnout looks like, and not just the simple number of turnout, but who's turning out and who's not. Because as John mentioned, it's really important for every election, and what we hope at Courage California is that our turnout reflects the actual electorate as much as possible. But year after year, we usually see that young voters, Latino voters, aren't turning out in proportion. And for us and for a lot of our partners, we feel like a lot of it is because a lot of these campaigns don't do the work, the important mobilization work, to really earn these people's votes. So what I am hoping to see is that we have good turnout, and I would like to really encourage, especially turnout among young voters and Latino voters and voters of color, women voters, people who are directly and most severely impacted by these policy decisions by the Trump administration and Republicans. So that's what I'm looking to see. And the results should also be really informative, given that we're going to go right from this to roll into the 2026 elections, about the work ahead of us, because it is not just about campaigns dropping into these districts and trying to talk to voters in the last couple of months, which is often what happens. But what we have seen work cycle after cycle is really working with the groups on the ground who have been in these communities, who are part of these communities, who are talking to their neighbors, to their communities, who are effective in turning out these voters. And so it really is about also encouraging folks to remember of the turnout for 2026 starts now, and it needs to start early, and it really needs to focus on these operatives, these groups on the ground, these trusted voices to the communities who are most impacted, and to the voices who we need to most hear from in these elections.
We should say that New York's mayoral race is seeing the highest early in-person turnout ever for a non-presidential election in New York, with an unprecedented surge in young voters who Zohran Mamdani has really mobilized. And we've got Trump and Elon Musk both endorsing Cuomo to thwart Mamdani's win. So we'll be talking more about that on Thursday. Irene Gao is executive director of Courage California. They fight for a more progressive California. John Nichols is executive editor of The Nation, the author of many books, including his latest, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Irene and John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great pleasure to be with both of you. Great conversation, Rose. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the government shutdown. This morning, Trump has threatened to deny food stamp payments to 42 million people until the shutdown ends, even though a federal court ordered the administration to continue funding the program. We will find out how this is affecting children and families in California. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today marks the 35th day of the government shutdown. This morning, Donald Trump threatened to deny food stamp payments to 42 million people until the shutdown ends, even though a federal court ordered the administration to continue funding the program. Here in California, more than one in five people struggle to put enough food on the table. Today, we're joined again by Andrew Shane, Managing Director of Public Policy for End Child Poverty California. Previously, Andrew was SNAP Deputy Director for the Food Research and Action Center. Hi, Andrew. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Tanis Crosby is executive director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank. They serve over 53,000 households every week. Hi, Tanis. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
And Reggie Young is executive director of the Alameda County Community Food Bank. Reggie's been working in food banking for over a decade. They distribute enough food to serve 60,000 people every day. Hi, Reggie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start off with you, Andrew. We had you on last week just talking about how people had no idea about what's to come. And so on the one hand, they learn that an appeals court tells the Trump administration that they have to, a federal court tells the administration they have to continue funding the program. So people think, okay, we're going to get our benefits. But this morning, Trump is threatening to deny the payments until the shutdown ends. What is this doing to people who are struggling to make ends meet?
Well, thank you for the question. And it's a really concerning moment, as you pointed out. The toxic stress, the physical hunger that's already been happening. Again, we know that SNAP benefits normally don't last the month, CalFresh food stamps, but here we are on November 4th. And as you pointed out, we have a situation in which the courts have ordered the USDA and the administration to issue benefits. The USDA did come forward with a plan this morning. It would be to do the minimum, to use the SNAP contingency fund and to issue partial benefits. They did so in a way that would be really complex. And I don't want to get into the math, but a lot of households actually wouldn't see a benefit at all under their calculation. But because of the complexity, it would take the California Department of Social Services, all states, quite some time to figure this out. It's not the case that it would be just to cut everyone's benefit in half. In the meantime, as you pointed out, the president and the White House have said that they are not going to honor that agreement, so it's unclear. And then the other piece is that the plaintiffs in the Rhode Island case filed additional paperwork this morning arguing that the USDA should be compelled to issue full benefits. And so that is the position that we continue to take at End Child Poverty California. USDA has the authority, it has the resources, and they should be issuing full benefits as soon as possible.
I also want to provide an update for people in San Francisco receiving benefits through CalFresh. That's 112,000 people. Last week, we talked about Mayor Daniel Lurie announcing that San Franciscans will still receive their benefits for the month of November. There was some confusion for people who don't use computers or QR codes. Well, KQED is reporting today, thanks to Carly Severn, that you will be receiving a prepaid grocery card this week from the city. And we will put a link on our website, kalw.org, click news, and then your call. According to the San Francisco Human Services Agency, all SNAP recipients in San Francisco will receive a letter in the mail this week with instructions on how to receive that grocery card. Do you know, Tanis, or actually Andrew, there was a lot of confusion last week or questions about people who said, I don't use a computer, I don't know how to use QR codes, how am I going to get this? Do we have any updates on that?
Yeah, I can start, and Tanis may have more information too. So my understanding is that as the cards are delivered, there will be a special 1-800 number for folks to call if they're not able to access the QR code, and then they will be mailed a physical card.
Okay. Tanis, do you have any updates?
Well, that's exactly it. And people are actually receiving their cards now. We have word that the cards are being received and people are starting to use them. This is a tremendously good news. This is a powerful example of public-private nonprofit partnership. San Francisco Marin Food Bank is proud to be a partner with HSA and Crankstart in this initiative. And we just want to give so much gratitude to Mayor Lurie, to Crankstart Foundation, to the Board of Supervisors. This is an example of what local leaders are doing to stem the tide. But, you know, the bottom line is that people in poverty across this nation continue to be a political bargaining chip, and it's not acceptable. SNAP is hanging by a thread, and it's being used as bargaining chip, and it's creating a significant amount of fear and confusion. And I want to remind listeners that even in the midst of this shutdown, which this is unacceptable, draconian cuts to the SNAP program have been approved and will roll out beyond this shutdown. This shutdown is foreshadowing how SNAP will be dismantled without urgent action. So our call is to fully fund SNAP now and fully fund SNAP beyond the shutdown, because people in poverty deserve access to these critical benefits.
And people might be wondering, what is Crank Start? So San Francisco partnered with the Crank Start Foundation to offer $18 million to CalFresh recipients. And thank you for that update, Tanis, because last week, listeners who don't use computers were really concerned about how they were going to access their card. You're executive director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank. What are you hearing from your clients? What are you hearing from families about the struggle that they're dealing with right now?
Well, it's this constant churn of uncertainty. Now, again, we're so fortunate that San Francisco has taken this measure for November, but even delaying the SNAP recipients is tremendously painful, tremendously harmful. And we still don't have any indication of what will happen for December payments. We're seeing a surge in requests for assistance. And I want to be clear, we already have a waitlist of 8,000 households. Food insecurity is the highest on record in San Francisco. That was before the shutdown. And again, the harmful, draconian measures that have been approved in July 4th's HR 1, otherwise known as the, quote, big, beautiful bill, will be so harmful and devastating. So it is an all hands on deck situation right now, responding to the shutdown, but we're not gonna let up. We are undaunted in working towards a future that is hunger free, both by providing urgent food assistance for what our families in our communities need right now, and working towards policies that are going to prevent hunger instead of cause it.
You have 8,000 people on a wait list?
Correct.
What are they doing?
Well, people are really struggling. And I also want to be really clear that 60% of the folks that are receiving our services are working families. These are folks that are struggling to make ends meet. We know that in San Francisco, one in three families aren't making enough because the wages are just not high enough. In Marin, it's one in four. You know, the root causes of hunger, insufficient income. And, you know, we cannot food bank our way out of the crisis that we're in. We need to ensure that we're working towards policies, again, that are going to work to end hunger, not cause it. So it's vital now that we ensure that food assistance is expanded and provided. And we need to make sure that good policy measures, like we saw in the pandemic, that reduced child poverty, we know that good policy works and that SNAP really is that first line of defense to be an anti-hunger, anti-poverty program. It's effective. It needs to be protected. It needs to be expanded instead of dismantled. We are undaunted in meeting the challenge of this moment today. We will persevere. It's a moment for our community to come together, and it's also a moment to recommit to the kind of policy and advocacy action that's going to be required going forward.
Tanis Crosby is executive director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank. We're also joined by Andrew Shane, managing director of public policy for End Child Poverty California. Reggie Young is executive director of the Alameda County Community Food Bank. If you have any questions for our guests, if you or someone you know is struggling to put enough food on the table or make ends meet, in addition to SNAP, because of the shutdown, federal assistance for heating bills and childcare through Head Start has also ended. And as we talked about last week, when you think about all of the people who were fired by the Trump administration who worked for the federal government, and then those who are not getting their paycheck, the system is just cannot keep up with so much demand, because there's more demand now because of all of these layoffs and firings. So if you have any comments, questions for our guests, if a story to share or resource to share, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. What about that, Reggie? You've got people who receive SNAP who are not receiving it, but then you also have federal workers who are not getting paid or federal workers who've been fired who are also in need of assistance.
That's absolutely right. Right now, we have about 177,000 people who are not receiving SNAP benefits in this moment. And along with that, there are tons of federal employees that are also waiting in lines for food in this moment. We've been doing distributions with a number of federal employees, including TSA agents at the airport. And the thing that a lot of them are telling us is that many of them are so excited about receiving the food items because that's the only thing that they can bring home to their families because they're not bringing home a check. And the reality is that a lot of these folks have to pay their bills. They have to pay for childcare. They have to pay for their gas to get back and forth from work. They have to pay for healthcare bills. And in this moment, they don't have any means of doing so. So for a lot of the folks that are receiving the food items from us, they're balancing out the cost of other things and leveraging the monetary value of the food items to support these other costs that they have in their lives. And in this moment, particularly for our federal employees, they're not being able to meet those needs.
What are you hearing from people, especially people who are on SNAP and just don't have the resources to put enough food on the table? What are people doing?
People are extremely nervous. People are scared. And people are also kind of angry. A lot of the folks are doing just what Tanis is saying, right? They're coming to pantries. They're trying to identify where they can access resources. A lot of our pantries are telling us that they're seeing record numbers of people coming to their sites, way more than at any point during the pandemic. And during the pandemic was huge. Right now, we're seeing pantries who are running out of food almost immediately after they're starting their distributions. And the folks that are at those distributions are really desperate. They're trying to ensure that their families are fed. Tana said it well. A lot of these families are working families. A lot of them are children. A lot of them are seniors. And they don't have other ways of getting these resources. So the big thing for them is to end the government shutdown so those resources can come through. But the reality is, even once the government shutdown is complete, HR 1's impact is going to have a dramatic impact. And Tana said this earlier. We believe that we're in a food crisis. We foresaw a food crisis even before the government shutdown. And we believe this is a prelude. What we're seeing today is a prelude to what we're going to be dealing with for years to come unless we do something different.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I just heard this morning that Trump is refusing to go with the decision of the federal courts that he has to continue SNAP.
Right.
Now, to me, this is the beginning of him defying court orders. I mean, well, the beginning, that's probably not the beginning. And where do we go from here? What do we do?
That's the big question. I'm just looking up shutdown right now to see if there's any breaking news. And NBC reports that some senators are predicting the shutdown could end this week. But you're right, Nancy, just in case you're just tuning in now, I want to get my facts straight on this. A federal court ordered the administration to continue funding the program, SNAP. Trump is threatening to deny food stamp payments to 42 million people until the shutdown ends. And the New York Times has a couple updates. I'll just read you. These were just posted a couple minutes ago. Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, said the administration was, quote, fully complying with a court order requiring it to pay food stamps this month. Her comments appear to walk back Trump's social media post that threatened to deny people the aid until the shutdown ends. And she's just accusing Democrats of playing politics. So we don't really know what's going to happen. I'm sure we'll know more by the end of the day in the coming hours. But as it stands right now, people are struggling to put food on the table and make ends meet.
Oh, yes. I know. I contribute to our local food bank. I've been contributing for years, and Meals on Wheels and all the rest of them. And I mean, I'm just, I'm appalled by all of this.
It's devastating, Nancy. Thank you so much for calling. Andrew, what would you say to people who are scared and don't really know where to go for resources, given that the food banks can't keep up? What are the options?
Well, I think people need to continue to access those resources. So I'll defer to my colleagues on the best ways that they can do that locally. Statewide, the best phone number to call is 211. It's available 24/7. It's in multiple languages. But people also need to take action, as my colleagues have said, and to channel that frustration, that anger, as you can. Obviously, people are in desperate circumstances, but to take action, to be providing mutual aid and solidarity in your communities if you're able, and also to be letting your members of Congress know that this is unacceptable, that they should be demanding that the USDA issue full benefits. We don't need the government to reopen for the USDA to do its job. But as my colleagues have said, we also want to see the government shut down to end without a reduction in access to healthcare. Obviously, it's so many of the same families who are struggling to afford health insurance to also put food on the table, afford rent and other basic needs. So we need to meet this moment in terms of helping out our neighbors, but also to be squarely focused on the policy changes needed to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
And that's why Democrats say that they are not going to budge on the shutdown, because they want Republicans to agree to continue with the Affordable Care Act tax credits. And if they don't, people's health care could double or in some cases triple. So that's the other issue that we're dealing with here. The New York Times is also reporting that a federal court scheduled a hearing for Thursday at the request of cities and nonprofits who are fighting to secure the release of full benefits under SNAP. Tanis, for people who don't know where to turn, what would you say to them? Where can they find resources?
Well, you can turn to your local food bank. In San Francisco, Marin, it's sfmfoodbank.org. But I do want to be clear, as much as we have a wait list, we are surging support with our partner network. We are advocating and coordinating to get those direct assistance payments out in San Francisco, and we're advocating for the same in Marin. And we are ramping up our home delivered grocery program. Our goal is to increase by another 5,000 households, but we need volunteers to do that. So every hour of volunteerism, it counts. Every dollar, it matters, and we stretch it really far. So now's the time to work together as a community. It takes everyone in our community to work to end hunger right now and always. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that what we're seeing right now is a policy crisis because of decisions that policymakers have made. And there is more pain that will come. Healthcare costs are scheduled to skyrocket. SNAP is being dismantled. So when this crisis is seemingly resolved, when eventually the shutdown no longer exists, we cannot stand by and let SNAP continue to be dismantled. So it's just so important for all the listeners to know what's at stake, because SNAP will be dismantled beyond this shutdown. With hunger at historic highs, we've got to make sure that doesn't happen.
Mm. Reggie, what would you add? We have a few minutes left.
So here in Alameda County, the thing that I'll just say is that as a food bank, this is what we do. We've responded to fires, we've responded to earthquakes, we responded during the pandemic, and we're gonna respond now. Us and our partner network are always gonna be ready to meet the needs during these times. If you're in Alameda County and you need food assistance, you can go to our website at foodnow.net to access all the pantry locations, including pop-up locations within our community. You can also call 510-635-FOOD or 510-635-3663 to also identify places where you can get resources. I want to emphasize something Tanis said, though. During the pandemic, we saw food insecurity and poverty decrease because of the government support that was occurring during that time frame. We know what it takes to end food insecurity in this country. Right now, food insecurity is at a dramatic high because those same supports are not being afforded during this time frame. This is not rocket science. We can ensure that our community is fed in the way that they need to, but we have to have the political will to do so.
Reggie Young is Executive Director of the Alameda County Community Food Bank. Tanis Crosby is Executive Director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank. Andrew Shane is Managing Director of Public Policy for End Child Poverty California. More than one in five Californians struggle to put enough food on the table. And today is the 35th day of the shutdown. This morning, Trump threatened to deny food stamp payments to 42 million people until the shutdown ends, even though a federal court ordered the administration to continue funding the program. And just a couple of quick updates. Thanks to KQED for this information. Today, the county of Contra Costa is going to vote on a proposal to send grocery debit cards to all SNAP users. 107,000 people are on CalFresh in Contra Costa. If you are in San Francisco and you are on SNAP, you will receive a letter in the mail this week with instructions on how to receive the prepaid grocery card. So be sure to look out for that. And every day, we're going to be giving you updates on the latest because so many people are affected by all of this. Tanis, Reggie, and Andrew, thank you all for your work. Thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate thank you. Thanks to Nina Kissinger for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. You can find resources at KALW.org. Click news and your call. You can also call 211 if you are in need of assistance. That is 211. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.